You're listening to 2A Radio with Bill Carnes.
Good morning. I hope your weekend went well. Mine went pretty well. I have to tell you about something I knew. I knew I was going to face this someday. About 22 years ago, 23 years ago, I took the very first gun I ever bought, which is a Ruger 10/22. Bought that the summer that I was 18. And that Ruger 10/22, I eventually put a little scope rail on it. Mounted up probably the cheapest scope money could buy at the time. And as it turned out, that scope rail that I had screwed into the receiver, of course, the receiver comes drilled and tapped, that the scope rail kept coming loose and coming loose and coming loose. So what does a 19-year-old kid do? Right? What does a 19-year-old, I guess it was about 20, 21 years ago. What does a 19-year-old kid do? Well, you fix it. What do you fix it with? Tools at hand, not duct taped, no, super glue. So yeah, you take super glue and you put it on the bottom of the scope rail. And you put it on the threads of all four screws that hold the base into the receiver. And quick like a bunny, you really tighten that thing down to get all this super glue holding it on there. Then, 20, 21 years later, you want to replace that and get that off the receiver. And I knew I was going to face this someday. I knew that I would face my indiscretions with that rifle someday. And I did. It was a week ago. I had to, I was putting a new rail on there. The one that I had was specifically very, very thin. It wasn't a standard Weaver rail. There's a couple of different scopes that I'd like to put on there. They take a larger ring that won't fit on this narrow, tiny little rail just for the Ruger. You can get a wider rail. So I got a wider rail, an aluminum wider rail for like 15 bucks. Right? Ready for the Ruger. So then I have to remove this old one. How do you remove the super glue? Well, you can use heat, you can use acetone, you can use all kinds of different things. I started using acetone. I got one screw out. The other three, I actually had to take a drill and drill the heads off of the screws to remove the base. I was able to then hand thread out one of the other four, one of the other remaining three. So two of the holes are gone. Two of them are clear, and those are the two in the back. In the front, not so lucky. As a matter of fact, I drilled through the head on one of them so far, I actually began to gall the top of the receiver. So now I'm feeling like an ass. I'm feeling like an ass because of what I did 21 years ago. Anyhow, I will now be heating the stubs that are left for the screw heads and going over to buddy of mine's house with a laser-sided drill press. And for my money, I think what we're going to do is take very small screws, screw out the center of the screws that are there, because I don't want to have to re-drill and tap the holes to mount the base. Drill out with a very tiny drill bit the center of the screws, and then put a little screw-removing thing, device in the hole, and try to get those screws out. I have taken the receiver completely apart, so I can either, you know, screw those screws. I can either back them out or push them all the way through the receiver because it goes through all the way. But I knew I was going to have to deal with this. I was going to do it this weekend. However, I had the house to myself. NASCAR was on yesterday. There was a couple other things going on. I don't even know if I left the house this weekend. I just relaxed, which is very unusual for me. I don't think I got in my car and went anywhere Saturday or Sunday. I think my car sat there still and did nothing. It was actually a wonderful experience, and I don't get to do that very often. So, anyhow, stayed at home and just did my thing. Guys, there's plenty to come. We're going to recap 2 days of testimony from Eric Scott later in the show and have something to read to you dealing with a detective from Las Vegas Metro you might want to hear. So stay tuned. I'm your host, Bill Carnes. You're tuned in live right here on 2A Radio.
It's not an option. It's a right. Cocked, locked, and ready to rock the world of the anti-gunners. You are listening to the guy who had to register his mouth as a full auto weapon. Bill Carnes and Two-Way Radio. The fight for your rights isn't for pansies. So buckle up for the ride and knuckle down with Bill Carnes and 2A Radio.
And a good morning it is to you. Welcome to 2A Radio. You know, we're having a very odd weather pattern here in Southern Nevada. We are moving up on the first week of October later this week, and we will be meeting it with 100 degree temperatures. It's been very, very pleasant. For some reason or another, there is a very high pressure system over this whole area of the state, out into the Pacific Ocean beyond California, and we are soaking up no wind, all kinds of sunshine, and roughly 100 degree temperatures. We actually hit that over the weekend. We are going to have Jim Dunson calling in a little bit later in the show to recap Friday and Saturday's Eric Scott involved coroner's inquest. And I also have something to read about that. But we actually have an early morning show caller, Leo in Massachusetts, on line one. Leo, welcome to 2A Radio.
Thanks for taking the call. I was fascinated by your replace the scope concept. One of my things as a machinist for 20 years.
Wait. Let me recap for some of the folks who just tuned in. I was speaking about a Ruger 1022 that I have, that I had a little a scope rail on the top, and it kept coming loose. So about 20 or 21 years ago, I did the young kid thing and super glued the scope base to the top of the Ruger 1022 receiver, and also super glued the four tiny little screws that hold it in there. Now I'm in the process of taking it off, and I'm having all kinds of trouble. So if you're a machinist, Leo, please tell me how to get these last two screws out.
Well, my question is, I'm not that familiar with guns per se. I'm familiar with different Rockwells. You know what Rockwell is, right?
I know it's a hardness scale rating. Other than that,
okay, right. Okay, my usual thing with removing a bolt or screw is that if I can't get the screw to come out the easy way, I tend to, first let me preface this thing quick. Are all the mounting points the same standard for each type of gun?
No, every gun has a slightly different setup, and that's kind of their unique thing.
So how do you get it to mount into the what I think would be a hardened barrel? Isn't the barrel hardened?
You don't put a scope base onto a barrel. You put it onto the receiver behind the barrel where the action is.
Oh, and did you check the Rockwell? The easy way to check the Rockwell is to take a pin punch, a center punch, and just try to put a dent in it. If you can't put a dent in it, it's super hard.
Well, I'll tell you this. The receiver itself is aluminum.
Oh,
yes.
Aluminum. You had trouble taking stuff out of aluminum? Wow.
It's super glued, man. And that super glue has been there for two decades.
Oh, I would have just put a grinder, a small grinder, just drill the screws out flat, put new holes in.
Yeah, the thing is putting new holes in where I'm dealing with steel screws and an aluminum receiver just doesn't seem to be the right way to go about it.
If you just took the thing off and flattened off the area and then re-drilled your new holes in your new place, because you know.
No, they'd have to be re-drilled in the same place. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, they have to be in this exact same place? They can't move back one screw's width?
Well, no, because nobody makes a scope base that has those holes back one screws width. People pre-make bases to go onto specific receivers. So if I custom drill holes, I will have no receiver to actually be able to mount on there.
Oh, so you actually have the exact same pattern to have to deal with.
Exactly.
Because I would have then left the base on, cut the top off, and just used the base as the new base, the old base of the, and then gone from there. In other words, leave the screws in place.
It's okay. I'm going to have to tear this thing up. If I have to go buy a new receiver, I will. But, Leo, I appreciate your interest and assistance. I do.
Okay.
All right, take care. All right, guys, we're going to talk for a moment here. You guys probably remember the O.J. Simpson book called If I Did It. Imagine if I actually was the guy who killed Nicole Simpson and Ron Goldman. This is probably how I would have done it. What it was a pseudo-confessional. Here's a piece I'm going to read, which I am going to give a little bit of information on it as well when I'm done. It says, my name is Brian Weiche, W-Y-C-H-E, and the Brian is B-R-Y-A-N, computer forensic specialist for the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. I was the only person with the means, motive, and opportunity to destroy key evidence in the Eric Scott shooting. That evidence did, in fact, go missing. Now, that's the way this starts. I doubt that Brian Weiche actually wrote this, but let's go on with this. Actually, you know what? I have somebody else calling about this receiver, and I could really use some help. So, John in Maine on line one, welcome to 2A Radio.
Hi, Bill.
I'm getting New England calling me with this. You guys up in New England must have good solution for us Westerners.
Well, no, not really. By the way, thanks for the tip on the concealed carry holster. I'm the fellow that emailed you that question.
Oh, okay, that's right. John, how are you? Good.
Great. I hope you're doing well. Listen, I ride motorcycles, plus I tinker on firearms. Been doing it since the 60s.
They're a great combination, too.
They are. Now, what you do on a motorcycle to break down, like, red, green, and blue Loctite is apply a little heat to the screw.
Yes, and I have a blowtorch for sure.
Well, I don't know that I would use a big blowtorch.
No, it's not a big one. It's just one of those propane cans you light up.
Okay.
You know, something you'd light a big cigarette with.
I also know that epoxy will break down under the judicious application of heat. So without melting your aluminum receiver, if you were to pass the torch across the screw area and get that hot where you couldn't hold onto it with a touch and then gently try to back the screw out, if that didn't work, apply a little bit more heat. I think you'll find that the heat will break the epoxy down and you will eventually be able to remove that screw.
Yeah, I think that is definitely my next bet before I actually have to go take in a smaller screw and trying to drill a smaller drill bit and trying to drill out those screw heads. But I appreciate that. I really do. So it looks like blowtorch is the way to go, John. Thanks very much for the insight.
You're welcome, and have a great day, Bill.
All right, you too. Bye-bye. Okay, back to this with Brian Weiche, computer forensic specialist for Las Vegas Metro Police Department. I don't know this guy from Adam. I have no idea who this guy is. But he says, if I did it, I did it like this. Around 5 p.m. on July 10th, the night Eric Scott was fatally shot and wounded, shot and killed, outside the Summerlin Costco, I was called to the scene to erase damning video evidence. If I did it. Surveillance cameras clearly capturing images of the three Las Vegas Metro officers shooting a man with no gun in his hands. The video surveillance system captured all seven shots that were fired. It clearly showed everything that transpired. And if you saw it, you'd be mad as hell if I did it. If I did it, I used my expert technical knowledge to erase certain segments of video data from the Costco hard drives. Officially, all I did was turn the system off and on. This technique completely fixed a system that had officially been inoperable for more than 2 days. Officially, 2 days prior to the shooting, one Shai Laree, a Costco employee whose job description does not include servicing the video system, noticed the expensive, sophisticated, state-of-the-art computer-controlled video surveillance system was not working, despite its redundant built-in backup systems. Officially, he called the vendor. Coincidentally, that vendor also services the surveillance system at Las Vegas Metro substations. If I did it, Liar Lee never made that call to Vegas Valley locking systems. The system was never down. No maintenance was ever really scheduled for the following Monday. But since VVLS also services Metro substations, their records now conveniently show a change order that was never really issued. If I did it. What motive did Liar Lee have for lying about this video systems being down? Liar Lee made the false 911 report alleging Eric Scott was a shoplifter with a gun that resulted in three Metro officers arriving on scene and ultimately ending the life of a very successful West Point graduate in the prime of his life. If I did it, no one will be able to recover the destroyed images. I am a professional. If I did it, and I'm not punished, I will do it again. If I did it, I am guilty of murder, perjury, obstruction of justice, and several other crimes that will land me in prison. If I did it. Now, this is someone else writing, as I can imagine, for Las Vegas Metro Computer Forensic Specialist Brian Wyke. Now, I don't know what this guy's role in it is. Hopefully Jim Dunsing will clear this up when he calls in later in the show. But I can tell you this. The lead detective for the Las Vegas Organized Computer Crimes Task Force, which is made up of Las Vegas Metro detectives, which also has allegiances with the FBI, the U.S. Marshal's Office, the Secret Service Office, is a personal friend of mine. I was the best man at his wedding. His name hasn't been involved anywhere in this, so I'd imagine he's never touched it. I haven't been able to get a hold of him to ask him. Maybe that's something that should scream. Anyhow, we're going to delve deeper into this Eric Scott thing. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. RoninTactical.com has certified concealed carry training specialists that travel to you and your group of self-protection advocates. Organize a group of friends, family, or co-workers who take their responsibility of self-protection seriously, and RoninTactical.com will send out a certified training specialist who will provide a course of instruction that will get you and your group certified to carry concealed in over 30 states while providing you, the organizer, a commission for organizing the event. Do you travel for work, family, or vacation and want to remain armed and safe when traveling? Contact RoninTactical.com for details on staying home and having one of our certified professionals travel to you to provide the training and credentials for you and your group to safely and legally carry concealed in over 30 states. Call 888-416-4809 or go online to RoninTactical.com.
Tell everyone in the room to pipe down. Two-way radio with Bill Carnes is back.
All right, for those of you who are either not up to speed or for some reason or other aren't really interested, I'm going to tell you why we're spending so much time on this show with Eric Scott. Eric Scott is a guy who walked into a Costco in Las Vegas, the Summerlin area of town on July 10th with his girlfriend, and he was looking at both coolers and metal, like reusable sports bottles of sorts, and trying to put the two together to find sports bottles that would fit in a cooler before he bought. And evidently, some store employee didn't like it. Another store employee called the cops and said, this guy's doing this, and we notice he's got a gun in a holster, and we don't allow guns here. He had just joined Costco earlier, went in, joined, and then went in the back and started shopping. Nobody told him he couldn't have a gun, because Costco doesn't post it. It's not in their paperwork. They don't say anything about it. They just have a policy that they don't let anybody know about, unless they catch you with the gun. Okay, so then he told him, look, I've got a constitutional right to do this. Come on, what is with this? So they finish up shopping, they go. Metro decides, this sounds like it's going to be an active shooter situation. We need to start setting up command posts and calling the dogs and calling the helicopter and all like that. Eric Scott walks out front, boom, boom, boom. Three cops shoot him dead, 7 rounds. 5 of them in his back. One of them enters into his buttocks and goes up into and lands in his chest cavity, the angle of which can only be done if you're lying down and shot from the back. So, We have an in-court reporter, as I would like to refer to him, Jim Dunsing, on the line. Jim, welcome back, man. How are you?
Good, Bill. Good morning.
Now, just for edification, so everybody understands, Jim Dunsing and I met as professional firearms instructors, so we're colleagues in that regard. Jim has a law degree. He's admitted as an attorney in the state of Nevada. I have used Jim as my own private attorney on a couple of occasions. And on top of that, Jim, just 11 months ago, was shot by Las Vegas Metro because he didn't want to get tased by a cop who didn't want to have a conversation with Jim. So Jim runs after he's getting tased due to a heart condition from as an infant, right? Premature?
I was born premature, right?
Right. So you have a heart condition.
Several heart issues.
From that. And you didn't really want to get tased and potentially lose your life, so you ran. And the cop decided to stop you with three rounds from his gun. So if anybody is qualified to sit in there and go through this coroner's inquest as someone that could call in and let us know what it is that's going on, it's Jim Dunsing. I mean, he's going to be more qualified at this than I am because I haven't been shot by Metro. However, I am a former Metro cop. So, Jim, they had another coroner's inquest that went on Friday after the show here, and then they also extended it and did it on Saturday. So you have 2 days' worth of information. I read the If I Did It in the last segment. Thank you very much for posting that on your Facebook page. And give us a little bit of update as to how things went.
Well, I want to correct something I did on the last show. In an attempt to try to get everything in under the wire, I tried to summarize some information. And Mosier, the cop, the shooter, testified before his cross-examination, testified that Eric's gun was in a holster where the trigger guard was accessible. And I did some research and only found that clip thing we talked about. Later testimony revealed that Eric had an Uncle Mike's holster, apparently. They've now shown a picture of the gun that he supposedly had. It was a Kimber in a cloth kind of holster, just the classic $10 holster you would buy anywhere, right?
Right, and I've seen that. It's got a clip like a money clip sort of a thing that it clips to the inside of your waistband.
Correct. Two things. One, I don't know if you can see it from the TV, but it looks from the image we've got in the courtroom that the hammer is forward, all the way forward, consistent with, say, Condition 3 carry, where the chamber is empty, the hammer is forward, and to shoot it, you need to rack the slide, load a round, and then you can fire it.
Correct. Rather than the proper way of carrying a 1911, which you have to train for, which is a full magazine, a round in the chamber, hammer cocked back, and the thumb safety locked on. Right, that's the proper way to carry a 1911. Jim, you carry a 1911. I carry a 1911. The guy that got me into Radio Dave Champion, he carries a 1911. We all carry what's called Condition 1, which is the proper way to carry a 1911. So this is whether or not it's a photo at the scene untouched or after somebody unloaded and did whatever they did, put it back in the holster, laid it down, and then took a picture. That is something that I don't know if that came out, the condition of that photo.
The cop said in his direct that the gun could be fired from the holster, and they made another question about that after some more issues came out during the questioning process. And the cop wants us to believe that inside that Uncle Mike's cloth holster, Eric could have stuck his finger basically in the holster and grabbed the trigger holster and all and pressed the trigger through the holster.
Right. Well, we will certainly get into the physical impossibilities of that when we return. We're headed into the break, Jim. Stay on the line. And folks, stay tuned. We're going to get into this because what we're talking about is split-second decisions that the cops are going to argue, but yet they're also bringing up things like when Eric Scott went to a doctor over a year before, we need to have all of this in context. So stay tuned. There's plenty more to come. You've got Bill Carnes, special call-in guest Jim Dunsing on the line right here on 2A Radio.
You're listening to a guy who packs a gun to shoot the bad guys and packs a mic to shoot his mouth off. Bill Carnes and 2A Radio are back.
All right, guys, welcome back. We have Jim Dunsing on the line now. What we're talking about is the gun and holster combination that Eric Scott is alleged to have when he was shot and killed by Metro. It was a soft side holster made out of something that's it's almost like a Nomex on the inside and a fleece on the outside, sort of a thing. Not quite to that level. It's not really Nomex. It's not really fleece on the outside, but it's a little comfortable to carry. But it's a floppy. It's a cheap little $10 garbage holster that I would never recommend. I don't think that Jim would either. And the trigger guard is covered on it, and it sounds as though the hammer was down and forward, meaning there's probably no round in the chamber. If there is, if you carry a 1911 with a round in the chamber and you by hand ease the hammer forward, you're just waiting for a negligent discharge and to fire off one of those rounds when doing it someday, so don't do that. And this is a Kimber, which is just a standard 1911. It's not like a para-ordnance LCP. Or something like that, LDA, which you can actually fire double action. We're not talking about one of those guns, are we, Jim?
Definitely a Kimber.
Yeah, okay.
And the hammer appears to be all the way forward, not in one of those little half-cock positions like some of the California guns have.
Yeah, that was like the LDA that I was talking about. And, you know, it's interesting. I have seen this photograph, and I have seen the holster, and I have seen the gun. And it looks like the guy definitely chose the right gun. What it doesn't look like is it didn't look like he had the proper holster or possibly the proper training to carry that gun looking at its condition. Because I had noticed exactly the same thing, that it wasn't in a firing position.
I know. Here comes all the firearms arguments and carry arguments and how you should do this and that. But the fact is some people carry in condition 3, typically a backup gun. And the only people who talked about Eric pointing the gun at the cops are the Costco employees and the shooter.
And now, only one cop fired, or did all three cops shoot?
The first cop fired 1, 2, or 3 rounds, depending on who you believe. And then the other cops fired their rounds.
Okay,
according to the testimony.
When you're saying the shooter, that you're talking about the guy that initiated pressing the trigger.
Correct.
Or in this case, by the bullet holes slapping and mashing the trigger, it sounds like.
Well, actually, it's like the first 1 or 2 shots went through Eric's torso.
Oh, okay.
So,
I thought those were follow-up shots when he was on the ground.
Well, there's still evidence to come out on that. But at any rate, the point that's interesting to me about this is even if it's if the gun's in the holster, hammer forward on a loaded round, which I think is very unlikely, even if it's in that case, you still have to manipulate that gun in some way to fire it.
Yes,
when
you
you've got 3 guns pulled on you and you're surrounded in that little area of the Costco exit, the idea that a West Point grad is going to think it's tactically wise to pull a gun, try to manipulate it so it can be useful, and then shoot, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. The testimony breaks down into a couple of categories. You've got the Costco witnesses and the cops saying that Eric pulled the gun and tried to kill the cop. You've got the majority of the other witnesses didn't see that. They saw either Eric have nothing in his hands, get shot, and drop nothing, or they saw Eric with something in his hands, get shot once, drop something, go into a surrender position, get shot 7 more times. Or they saw Eric trying to kind of turn his back towards the cop, kind of half turn, show him, hey, I've got a gun, and try to reach for it in a slow kind of surrender. I'm going to hand it to you from the grab the slide.
Yeah, which, by the way, guys, is a mistake. Verbalize if you've got a gun. Don't go showing it to the cops. You can tell them where it is. That's something you don't want to do because you might end up in the same ugly situation. Not that it's an excuse for the cops to go ahead and shoot you, but if you have a gun and the cops have their guns out pointed at you, put your arms in the air, tell them, I'm carrying a gun, it's in this place. Or just listen to them and don't say a word. They'll find the gun. It's okay. Anyhow, carry on, Jim.
Well, yeah, you're talking about the practical reality. I mean, there's no reason for if this guy's got military training, Mosier, and Mosier did, and he comes to the scene knowing that this the suspect has military training, there's no reason for the guy to overreact the way he did.
Yeah, and what you're doing is you're relaying the information where the 911 caller, one of the Costco employees, had articulated that Eric Scott claims that he had been in the military, and I think he even claimed that he said Eric Scott had said that he was a Green Beret, which nobody that's ever met Eric Scott believes he would ever say such a thing. Having learned a bit about his history, doesn't seem as though he would say that, but you know, we don't know. We weren't there. But that right there would tell the arriving officers that somebody's had military training. So that's what Jim is articulating, just for the listening audience.
Right, and you and I have seen people get their guns off, and there's a distinct difference between I'm pulling a gun on you, and we've all both had guns pointed at us. There's a distinct difference between I'm pulling a gun on you and I'm taking this gun off the hand to you.
Yeah, and on top of that, if you pull a gun out of a holster, now keep in mind, that particular holster that we saw the photograph with the gun in has no retention to it at all. The inside of that holster is very smooth. It's a very, very smooth, tightly woven nylon sort of an affair. And the gun, if you, and it's clipped on with a very, it's got a lot of pressure to it inside the waistband. You pull the gun out, and what happens is that clip keeps the gun, the holster, inside the waistband. The gun comes out of the holster very smoothly. The only way to remove the gun and holster at the same time is to grab it in something other than a firing grip. Grab the holster and pull the holster out so you're holding onto the holster and not the gun. That's the only way to get those two out together. You can't just grab the gun and that holster is going to come with it. If you have a hard side inside the waistband holster that only clips on, sometimes those will come out. But those soft side ones, the kind of a felt sort of a finish, I guess it's kind of a felt kind of outside, will actually stick to the inside of your garment and against your body. And then the smooth inside, the gun comes out cleanly. So, again, to pull the gun and holster out together has to be intentional. I want them both to come together. I'm not drawing the weapon to shoot somebody. It just, it doesn't work that way with that combination of gun and holster.
Correct. Yeah. Again, there's some testimony that the gun was still on Eric's person after he was shot. And there's some testimony that the gun was some feet away.
Yeah, didn't a paramedic say that he took the gun off of Eric? Wasn't the gun and holster on Eric's body when the paramedic finally got there about 5 minutes after he was shot?
I don't remember seeing an actual paramedic testify.
Perhaps he hasn't testified yet. It might have been coming off of a report that I read where someone had interviewed him.
Possibly, but I don't. I know they found. Apparently, they found another gun in the ambulance. Is the story? They haven't really discussed that much in the hearing, and no one I'm talking to outside of that is familiar that might be.
Yeah, because we heard news reports early on that he had two guns on him, but yet we're only hearing about this Kimber. The other gun seems to be some kind of a little mystery or something. Huh? Who knows? But I'm sure we'll find out in the next few days.
Well, and they still haven't told the jury that the Kimber was registered to Eric, and they still haven't told the jury, you know, they haven't brought in a crime scene analysis or analyst or a gun expert to look at the gun and tell everyone what condition it was in.
Okay, do you know if those sorts of people are on the witness list to be called?
I don't, because the witness list is they're produced it kind of a day at a time.
Oh, gotcha.
I'm not even sure when the other two shooters or the other cops who were apparently on the scene by the time the shooting took place. It appears there were two or three other police officers within viewing distance when the shooting actually occurred and didn't have their guns out.
Understood.
So I'm assuming they're going to be called to testify at some point too, and we haven't seen any cop but Mosier testify.
Okay, and that was actually on day two that he testified, correct?
I'm sorry, man, it blends together. I'm not sure. It was earlier. I think it was.
It was early. Day one or day
last
two?
Last witness, I think, of day two and then the first of day three.
Gotcha. Okay. And day three and day four is what we're recapping now. You've had 4 days worth of testimony. And by the way, this has got to be a lot of long hours for you to spend your time, effort, and energy going down there. And of course, America appreciates it, hearing straight from the mouth of somebody who's actually there all day long and witnessing this sort of testimony.
It's far less long for me than it is for Bill and Linda Scott.
Absolutely.
Listen to the lies and not be able to put on any evidence through their son's name or put on a case or really get their view out in this process. You know, they're really forced to sit there and handwrite questions so that they can try to get some part of their story out and defend their son's name in some way.
I understand in 4 days of testimony, there's been some 1,300 questions that have come up due to the testimony that have come out of the family and other interested parties that has been submitted to Tony Abbotangelo, who's kind of running the show here. He's the magistrate. He is officially a judge, but they don't actually call him a judge in this particular coroner's inquest process in this venue. But 1,300 questions. That means he's getting about 125 questions. What is it? 325 questions a day. Let me try to do my math. 325 questions each day submitted to him. People have got to be scribbling questions at light speed, and then he's got to go through all of these.
Yeah, the front row consists of the family, and on the left side of the chamber, and they're. From the moment someone starts to testify, they're not able to keep, complete notes because they're busy trying to write out questions.
Sure.
And it's an unfair process. It's difficult. But yeah, they're scribbling and writing these questions out, submitting them, and doing a questioning of a witness. You can't just randomly throw your questions up there and have the same effect as you can, ask 10 questions and. Kind of let the witness lead where you go with it,
right.
Based on their answers. So there's a huge disadvantage in the process, but still, they're asking questions that the prosecutor isn't.
Obviously, because the prosecutor.
It's somewhat beneficial.
It seems as though the prosecutor's there to set the groundwork to have a justifiable or, at very minimum, excusable justification rationale come out of the jury. That's sort of adjudication he's setting the groundwork for by going back and talking about different prescription medications that Eric was on, why he was on them, the doctor's visit he's gone to, but won't let the family get the question through the judge. What about the cops? Were they on any prescription medication? What is their medical history? That's not coming out of the cops. They're just laying the groundwork to justify why Eric Scott should have been shot and killed, why he's dead, and make sure that it's okay. And Jim, we have about 3 minutes left, so what I want to do is just hear about some of the highlights that from Friday and Saturday's testimony that you think are appropriate.
Well, before we get to that, some of the questions that are being asked, those 1,300 questions, ask exactly what you just talked about.
Oh, good.
And the judge, in his discretion, has chosen not to use those questions. He's supposed to read those questions, but like you said, he's got a stack of 1,000 or something unread questions that gets bigger every day, and they're not really catching up in the process with the old questions. So I'm wondering when they're going to read these questions into the record so the people at home and the people in the courtroom can hear which questions the judge decided not to ask. But the important parts of the testimony are kind of what I've recapped to you. They brought on in the last 2 days several eyewitnesses whose recollections vary. Grandmother whose granddaughter pointed out the fact that officer has his gun drawn, Grandma, which is how she puts events to doctors and lawyers sitting on the bench outside who watched the whole thing develop. And it seems to me like those doctors, those lawyers, the people who saw the whole thing start to finish, and who remained more calm than some of the other people,
mm-hmm.
have not seen a gun in Eric's hand. Some of the people who were scared to death, all they remember is a gun.
Right. The history will show that gun could, in your mind's eye, be placed almost anywhere if you're not used to seeing their gun. Like, you and I would probably be fantastic witnesses to something like this. We've seen guns. We've both been shot at. You've actually been hit. And we've actually had a lot of guns in our hands and been around a lot of people with guns. So that's not foreign to us. That's regular sort of, professional fare. So, but yeah, to have a little girl and people that are really emotional on the stand, really seems to be a cheap shot, is what it seems to be.
Well, they didn't bring a little girl, but they brought her grandmother, who was very understandably scared for her granddaughter, and beside herself, seeing someone get shot. And so her testimony is she never actually saw Eric have a gun, but he must have, because that kind of horror couldn't have taken place if he didn't deserve it.
Oh, yeah,
in her mind.
There's certainly some rationale. Yeah, he had to have a gun. Otherwise, the cops would have never shot. We never would have witnessed this. Jim, thanks a bunch. Are you going to call in again tomorrow?
I will if you'll let me.
Absolutely. Love to have you, because the inquest process starts in about an hour and 10 minutes, so we're going to let you get to it and get a good seat, man. Thanks very much for calling in.
All right. Thanks, guys.
All right, guys. We are going to head into break in just another moment here, and we certainly have more to come after the break. Stay tuned. You're tuned in live right here to 2A Radio. If you live in a state which allows Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories, and you either have an interest in or already own Class 3 NFA items, the process for an individual to own these items includes photographs, fingerprints, obtaining a letter of permission from your police chief or sheriff, and a full personal background check, which is spread across the whole federal system. Until now. Forming an NFA trust eliminates the requirements of letters of permission and all personal data and background checks in purchasing and possessing NFA firearms and accessories. NFA trusts offer a level of anonymity as well as flexibility in the purchasing, possessing, and storage of your Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories. To learn more about forming a secure and flexible NFA trust at a fraction of the cost from attorneys, visit www.billcarnes.com and click on the NFA tab. That's BILLCARNS.com and click on the NFA tab.
As long as politicians attack our rights, Bill will be fighting for them. 2A Radio with Bill Carnes is back.
Back off, I'll take you on. Headstrong.
All right, guys, welcome back. On Friday, one of the segments, we had Justin Campbell in from RoninTactical.com. Ronin Tactical has decided to come on board as a sponsor of 2A Radio, so I would like to play for you the new commercial spot you'll be hearing dealing with them. RoninTactical.com has certified concealed carry training specialists that travel to you and your group of self-protection advocates. Organize a group of friends, family, or co-workers who take their responsibility of self-protection seriously, and RoninTactical.com will send out a certified training specialist who will provide a course of instruction that will get you and your group certified to carry concealed in over 30 states while providing you, the organizer, a commission for organizing the event. Do you travel for work, family, or vacation and want to remain armed and safe when traveling? Contact RoninTactical.com for details on staying home and having one of our certified professionals travel to you to provide the training and credentials for you and your group to safely and legally carry concealed in over 30 states. Call 888-416-4809 or go online to RoninTactical.com. So there you go. That's a commercial spot that we cut for RoninTactical.com. Again, these are professionals. These are all people that I know and I have worked with. And what they'll do is if you want to get concealed carry permits to carry in several states, you get a group of people together, call Ronin Tactical or go to RoninTactical.com, and they will send someone out to you and get you trained up. Now, to be able to carry in over 30 states, 32 states, I think it is, you can get a couple of different permits. And those particular permits, there is no actual shooting involved. Now, you need to be able to have a venue, a place for them to be able to come out. a place that will allow guns, so you can go through basic gun handling information, information on cleaning and all that other good stuff that are requirements of the class, which will take a few hours. And, but there's no actual going out to the range and shooting. If you want to take your group out to the range and shoot, these are professional instructors. They're just not people that will pencil whip off a bunch of, concealed weapons permits. Well, what you do is you come out, they come out there, you will go through the training. If you want to do some range work, find an appropriate range. They'll take you out and do the range work as well. And then they give you all the information and you send in to get the permits from outlying states. They send the permits mailed back to you, so you don't have to go to different states to get all these different permits. All you have to do is import one instructor, and that one instructor, they have several on staff. One instructor will come out there and get everything set up. So there's RoninTactical.com. Check that out. R-O-N-I-N Tactical.com. We want to thank them for coming on board with 2A Radio. I'd like to close by saying, to those of you within our government, we will be watching you in Congress, the executive, and judicial branches all very closely as we organize to save our freedom, liberty, and country. We will not become the subjects of governmental rule.
Thanks for tuning in. Bill will be back tomorrow. Now go side in and shoot straight. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Karns. Learn more about Bill at BillKarns.com. Send your comments to Bill at 2aradio.com. I will not.